This is Carolyn Evers welcoming you to The Messenger, and we have an incredible, wonderful author here today by the name of Dr. Christine Page. She is a real sister in the light and certainly a well-educated teacher of the light, and we are just so proud to have her. I met Dr. Page on some journeys that we did with the Mary Magdalene energies, and I have to tell you, she is a wonderful lady. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good to be with you.
Chris, you have so many letters behind your name, and I have to honor all of the education and the effort that you put into to get all these credentials. Tell me what some of these letters mean.
Well, the first ones are very much to do with my medical degree. So I'm an MD by profession and have been for now almost 30 years. And then on top of that, I did furthered my qualification within my medical profession in pediatrics and OBGYN, and then went on and got qualifications to be a family doctor, a general practitioner. And then I think the final letters I've got there are my homeopathic degree, which is my branch where when I branched out into complementary medicine, that was what really took my interest. I'm a homeopath as well.
Well, that certainly gives us a broad background to work with, doesn't it?
It does.
This is Dr. Page's latest work, Spiritual Alchemy, How to Transform Your Life. And she has written four other books, so this is the latest in her journey. And I have to tell you, Chris, this is the sort of book that one does not sit down and read through cover to cover. There is so much incredibly beautiful information in here. I would say it's the kind of book that a person is going to open, and it doesn't matter what part of the book that you open. You can just open any place and pick up something that's going to interest you. And what I love about the way that you have set this book out is you give a little bit of information. She's got diagrams in here to support what she is discussing. And then she gives experiences from other people to illustrate what she is saying. But then there is, in each chapter, questions to help a person to move inside and work with the information. And it is a very complete book. And so before we get into some of this marvelous information, I just wanted to read what is on the back of the book, and because I really think it's important for our audience to know just how respected you are by other people in the profession. And this statement was made by Dr. Norman Shealy, who is an MD and a PhD. He's a professor of energy medicine, and this is what he says of Dr. Page. Christine Page is one of the great living mystics and has presented us a modern map of the journey we must all ultimately take to fulfill our cosmic yearning. This will become required reading by our students. Well, I was impressed by that.
I was impressed by that.
You know, I just love the word alchemy. This is one of those words that, you know, you just curl up to and you just have to love. How would you what would be your impressions or your descriptions of the word spiritual alchemy? How would you explain that to a person?
I like to take it very simply, which is if you take the word and you call it all chemistry, and the other way of looking at it is all composition. So alchemy is to know thyself, to know all aspects of yourself, and that in knowing all aspects, you literally become the enlightened being that we already are. You allow your light to shine. And so I feel that at this time we're all being asked to remember who we are and literally bring home all those parts that have been left out in the shadows And to do that, we use the techniques of alchemy, which is literally the elements, the fire, the earth, the air, and the water. I hope that gives a guideline there.
Well, it certainly does. And, you know, the word alchemy has had so many meanings in the past, and I wanted to understand the perspective you were coming from when you wrote this book, and that certainly does tell the story. There were just so many places in this book that I positively loved, and I put paper clips and highlighted some of the sections that I particularly liked. And as I go through this, it's not that I felt one was more important than the other, because to me, every one of these sections are equally important. But in the beginning of the book, you're talking about self-worth. Look at your name and the date of birth and see what is revealed.
Mm. Yes.
Perhaps you might want to comment on that in some aspect.
Well, I divided it two sections. One is, I think the second part is that I'm a great believer in numerology. As you know, at the end of the book, I actually do enter in the information about your name and your date of birth, giving us a frequency, giving numbers by which we can know you more fully. And I just love numerology. I believe, and I hope our audience does, that we actually choose our name. We choose our date of birth and when we'll be born and where we'll be born, which, of course, adds into the astrology. But in simple terms, just understanding your date of birth that will give you a number, it will help you to understand the very essence of why you're here. And what we do is we add up those numbers and we bring it down to usually a single figure. And in very simple terms, if, for instance, you were one, in some level, you have to be a leader in your life. And then I was also looking at the name itself. Well, it's easy for me. I've got a name called Paige, and Paige is or was the original messenger for the king. And
oh,
I feel that I'm living out that messenger role. Interestingly, my mother's name was Hawkins, so I carry the hawk, which is also the messenger. So I think I'm doing this pretty well.
You got it on both sides of the family, don't you?
I picked good parents.
Well, something that ties into that I was very intrigued with was, and I'm looking here through the book, you could probably help me out, was it wasn't the order that I was going to discuss it, but it ties right into this because it talks about the spider woman.
Right.
And if I find that paperclip, before I find that paperclip, you can get into that and tell our audience how the spider woman is weaving an awareness, and because this is kind of connecting with our parents, the parental, what we've gathered or what they have contributed to us.
Absolutely. The Native Americans primarily talk about grandmother spider woman. And they talk about her being, as you say, the great weaver of the universe, but also of our own destinies. And I love the idea of that, of us weaving this tapestry of our life. And what I saw was that we literally choose our parents, our culture, our heritage in many different ways, maybe our gender, our religion, and we walk into it as if we're walking into a spider's web. And we become imprinted by the energies or the frequencies or that we are being handed down from our ancestors, from these religions. We literally wear that as our clothes, our personality. And in that, we pick up, one might say, the strengths of our family, but we also pick up some of the challenges of our family, that you could say weaknesses. And what I say to everybody, including myself, is that if you want to know why you're here, look at your family, because they will be your greatest teachers, but they're often also your greatest mirrors. So the ones that you find are easy to get on with, you'll see yourself reflected, or I'm just like that parent, or I'm just like that brother or sister. But then there are the ones that you really don't even start to understand. And they may include even your children, who you wonder whether or not you picked up the wrong child in the nursery because you just don't get on with them. And they will be the areas where you are here to explore yourself, to learn. And so the aspects that are sometimes difficult for us to understand, in a parent especially, will be the ones that we need to draw attention to. And I just want to say, you know, it's not just the fact that when you met your parent, they perhaps were in a state of decline, or let's say they were less than they were. Sometimes we have to look back and say, who were they in their teenage years? Who were they before they became miserable? Who were they before they became abusive to themselves or others? And sometimes what we're doing is picking up the baton and we're running with it. So what is it they never fulfilled that you're willing to take further? And that's really the journey that I see us doing and that the spider woman is trying to help us to understand.
I find that such an interesting concept, because so many times among families there is this point in a child's life where they're really rebelling against the standards or the belief systems of their parents.
Right. And I think that's a healthy attitude. I think in our teenage years we have to find ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a point where we both have our own soul's journey, and in many cases that soul's journey is going to be intertwined with completing ancestral karma. And what I would say is that many a time we're here to untie a knot that has been in place many generations. Nobody's ever got past the knot. And what we do is we complete something, or we do it differently, and we release all the ancestors for at least the last three generations, if not the last seven generations. And we release that knot for the next seven generations to come.
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up, Chris, because I have some friends who energetically work with breaking knots from the past. And it's there for all of us. We have to overcome this. And so for a person, an individual that does not have another energy worker to work with, do you have any suggestions as to how an individual might clear these past ancestral karmas or knots?
I wish that I could say there was an easy way, Karen. I usually suggest to people who I'm working with, they write down six aspects of their parents. And that doesn't have to be positive or negative. They can have a mixture. And to ask themselves, what if they looked at those six aspects of their parents, which do they see in themselves, and which do they see that they have difficulty owning within themselves? And if your parent had something that became less than fruitful, what I'd say is, if instead of them being able to strive forward with an idea, they were always scared of their ideas being put out there, so they became rather pessimistic about life, where are you having the courage to take things further? Where are you going to create where they never managed to? Where are you going to allow love in where they never managed to? And I would say this may well be, this is more of a life story, but it is something that I would say, if you want to know why you're here on this planet, you look at some of the challenges of your ancestors, and particularly the illnesses of your family. Because if you understand illness as being, once again, a mechanism for helping us to move forward, many a time what we call a familial pattern is just one where we keep repeating the same sort of behavior or belief or perception about life, and we take it from one generation to the next. For example, heart disease. We know in heart disease many a time the individual feels as if they're in a cul-de-sac, that they can't get out of it, that they have should, musts, and oughts in their life, and that the joy of life seems to have left them. And so if I saw that my family had a strong history of heart disease, I'd be saying, okay, what do I want to do differently? How can I bring joy into my life? And that would be a way of breaking those old patterns.
You know, that is a fascinating awareness. I am just so intrigued with that. Have you made a list of, say, different illnesses and how they are categorized with these attributes?
I have indeed. That was my first book. It's called Frontiers of Health. And I wrote as many illnesses as I could based on my experience of being a doctor for all those years and watching people bringing the same sort of personality to each of the illnesses.
That is fascinating. Well, I'm sure going to have to get that book.
Thank you.
Where do people usually buy your book?
They certainly can find them. Obviously, Amazon has them. Many good bookstores have them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're always able to provide them. If anybody wants to go onto my website, which is christinepage.com, we have an online booking system there that they can buy them online.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad you mentioned that because I didn't notice your website, and I certainly wanted to get into that because I would highly recommend Spiritual Alchemy, and now that we've touched on this Frontiers of Health, I think that's another one we got to talk about sometime. Moving on, there is interesting information here about the different cycles of energy, you know, the nurturing, the blooming, and
yes.
so forth. Did you want to give a little information on those cycles?
Yes, I think that, again, it was something I saw in my own life, but also in people I worked with. And I see that, I mean, it's not new because we all understand the seasons, and some places in this country understand it differently than others. But there are the four seasons, the spring, the summer, the fall, and the winter. And that the first stage is giving the birth and nurturing that birth of a seed. And what I found was that some people found difficulty even just doing that. They would have a good idea, but they had difficulty either putting the seed out there because someone had told them that they couldn't do it, or they planted the seed and then they forgot to nurture it, which I have to say I've had a tendency to do. Once we've set that seed in motion, we've got it nurtured, the next stage is the blooming, and that I see as the summer. And again, I was surprised both in myself and in others how difficult it is to praise ourselves, how difficult it is to celebrate what we've achieved. It's like being a rose and saying, well, I'm not really any good, I'm not a very good rose, look at the other roses, they're much better than my rose. And I have been using the word celebration a lot because I found that the word gratefulness was okay, but celebration just embodied that blooming experience, that sense of, yes, I'm here. And so I encourage anybody to write a list of maybe the three things in their life that they would really celebrate and really give themselves a pat on the back and maybe buy some flowers or do a little party, because we don't spend enough time celebrating our achievements. Because often what happens is either we're told that's not okay, nobody wants to hear, or we're on to the next thing. And then the next stage of it was the fruitfulness, the harvesting, the fall, where the most intriguing part of this for me was how the mother animal would eat the placenta after the birth. And I realized this was eating the fruits of your endeavors. And again, it's part of the celebration, but do you feed yourself with what you've achieved? Do you allow that wisdom and that joy to enter in? And again, I found in women's cycles, that was a stage where progesterone was particularly low. Because we were so busy being busy in our estrogen time, we would be doing all this planting of seeds, but we couldn't nurture ourselves once we'd planted that seed and allowed it to come to bloom. And the last stage was, of course, the winter, which is the stage of the dying, which was, could you allow that which is dead to die? And once again, we have in our culture, a great tendency to worship that which is the hero or that which is form, but we're not very good with the dying. We're not good at just letting people go into a place where they need to let go and go into perhaps a decline, take some time out before that next breath or that next seed to be planted. And I could see myself in all those cycles, but I suggested to my readers and to the listeners that this is really important to see which stage are you most comfortable with and perhaps which stage are you least comfortable with, and really focusing on, obviously, the ones you're least comfortable with.
Working, like I said, there's just so many topics in here, and there is so much to really think about. There's a section in here about working with the labyrinth. And I was particularly intrigued with this. Do you find, well, you talk about two different kinds of labyrinths, the shark labyrinth and the cretin. Energy-wise, have you noticed a difference between the two of these?
I have. I think you and I both know that the shark one was created primarily around the Mary, around the mother, around the feminine, and it has a very specific design because of having four sections to it. It was also created by the Knights Templars, who were wanting to define the ability to experience the Grail, the center of our being. And so it, I think, more clearly and precisely talks about those four different sections that I've just mentioned, and allows us to walk them in a way that brings everything together into the center. Where the Cretan one has its seven levels, I think that it is, as I said, the shark one is more complete. What I love about labyrinths is that you think, you know, in simple terms, it would just be a matter of starting on the outside and working in. Well, the beauty is, of course, you think you're going towards the center, and all of a sudden you're thrown out to the outside. And I feel that the labyrinth is a great joke. I mean, it really is. It's about where your ego is caught up with trying to get to the center, because all of a sudden you're on the outside again.
Did you ever have the opportunity to be in chart?
I have indeed.
I was just wondering if you had the great joy of being able to walk the labyrinth.
I have, but I think I would like to go back again with all the knowledge I now have.
Isn't that the truth? I had a friend say to me, experience is something that you get when you don't need it anymore.
Exactly.
I had walked the labyrinth also at Shark, and we did that after the church had actually closed. And it reopened in the evening hours, and we had 20 people who had that whole cathedral to themselves.
Wow.
And we moved the chairs, and we walked the labyrinth, which was just incredible. And so this was lit mostly by candles and the setting sun as it was coming in through the rose window.
Wow.
And the interesting thing about that, Chris, is every time you made a turn in the labyrinth, you wound up facing the rose window. I was so impressed by that.
Beautiful.
So maybe you and I will just have to find a trip and go over there and do it now that we have all this knowledge.
Exactly. That would be wonderful.
And since we were kind of talking about Shark and the Templars and so forth, it brings us up to Chapter 3, which talks about the Philosopher's Stone. And that kind of really ties into that.
It really does. I think that even since I wrote that book, I have become more and more intrigued by the Philosopher's Stone, and really also tying it so much to the Grail.
Yes.
And I think that now that I've done even more work with the alchemy, I understand that in Jung's term, we are the Philosopher's Stone. I like that idea, that it isn't something external. It is what we develop through our very process. And I've come to understand that it literally is the part of us that is pure essence. and that what we're here to explore or to unearth is our pure essence. So it could be that it is another way of saying that the Philosopher's Stone is already present within us. We've just got to take the layers off to find it. But it's part of our process to put on, how can I use, it isn't just a revealing, it is also by the work we do, do we reveal our light. And so what I'd say to myself is, if I'm someone who never takes any risks and stays just around the center of my being, I won't bring enough energy back to my center to be light, be strong in my light. So the more I meet myself in my shadows, the more challenges, or one could say the risks I take, in terms of coming away from my comfort zone, the more I'll discover my own Philosopher's Stone.
And how close do you think this process is to the Mary Magdalene energies?
I think it's very close. However, I feel that I would say there's one thing. I don't think it is purely just her womb that is the grail.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it's the heart.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that we all are being asked to come back into our hearts. And I believe that the Mary Magdalene and the Jesus character, if we accept that they were married, it was their union, that they were trying to show us through their union we meet ourselves in our hearts when the two are brought together. And so it isn't one person or one thing. It is about the union between different aspects of ourselves.
Beautifully put. And I think that is great wisdom. In that particular chapter, I'm intrigued with another word, and that is Tantra.
Yes. Well, of course, Tantra has had so many different meanings put to it.
Yes, it does. And you sort of give a little description of how the words can be used. And, you know, most of us aren't too familiar. Well, maybe I'm judging this wrong, but this was probably true to say this is a land of Christianity, and perhaps we're not too familiar with the Hindu aspects of Tantra and the elements of polarity between the male and the female. Perhaps you could, in the book it's so well put, perhaps you could give us a few thoughts about that.
Yes, I will do. In the Hindu tradition, they understand that there are two parts, the male part called Shiva and the female part called Shakti, and that the Shakti energy is this serpentine kundalini energy which is curled up at the base of the spine. And it is through the awakening of that serpent that eventually the serpent moves up our body, and there is Shiva, the male energy, waiting at the top to have this unique and exquisite union with its divine, its partner, its beloved. And it is these divine marriages of opposite that I think Tantra is connected with. We often, as you said, it was noted that it was all to do with sexuality. But the biggest issue is that sexuality is not the problem either. The ability to raise one's kundalini occurs through the act of sexual intercourse, but not only through the act of sexual intercourse. And I think this is where we've got a little closed down, that truly when you feel, when you're inspired by something beautiful and you connect with that, you become one with that beautiful sunset or that one with that beautiful sunrise, literally that will give your kundalini a chance to rise. So what I'm wanting to say is the tantric experience is a unity. It's a connection between two opposite fields again. And it is when we're in relationship with something else that we will have a tantric experience. And that may or may not be a partner, it may or may not be through intercourse, but it's available to us all. And unfortunately, I feel there's been a lot of misinformation given, because once we can have that experience that tantric rising of our kundalini, we truly can have that without needing to go through a secondary person or culture or religion to find our own God. I.e., this is our union with our own God.
I really like that definition of yours, because I think most of us have this concept that it has to be a sexual union to express Tantra and to raise Kundalini. But you're talking about identifying with beauty. For someone who has not raised their Kundalini, how, let's say a person does see a beautiful sunset and they're just enthralled with it, is there any signs, physical signs, mental signs, emotional signs that they might be going through that tells them that perhaps they are raising Kundalini or in the beginning stages of Kundalini?
That's a great question. I mean, without the dramatic experiences that some have, when they have literally a bliss state that can go on for days, most people feel it by having a shivering or a tingling, or their hair feels it standing on head, or their heart feels warm. I defy anybody not to have a moment of joy, and that's what I'd rather call it, that moment of connection where time seems to stand still, where nothing else matters in that moment. You're just transfixed by whatever it is that's taking your attention. And it can be with a loved one, it can be watching grandchildren, but it's that moment where you're not in your head, you're in your heart, and your body, as I say, may be tingling. And for many of us, it's as if you say, wow, everything looks better at this moment. Everything's brighter, everything's happier. And the more you think of that joy, the more you'll bring it on. So the more, as a magnet, we experience that feeling, so remembering a moment like that and feeling what it was like in your body allows us then to attract more of that towards us. And it just cycles on and on.
You answered the question that was in my mind. In essence, the more times you become part of this, the easier it gets to be, and the more the energy you're drawing to yourself.
Absolutely. And what I would say very importantly, Carolyn, is that people try and do this through seriousness. Seriousness is not on. Seriousness is just boring to the universe, I think.
I think you're right.
Because, you know, when you're serious, you're only using your will. You think there's something really important about you and you have to do it this way. When you watch children in that moment of ecstasy exploring life, they do it with joy. And animals do the same. I mean, I'd be watching a little kitten in my garden just so enjoying playing with things. It didn't really care about what it was doing. It was so engrossed with that moment. And that is what I know, the innocence that we need to remind ourselves about. That doesn't mean a childishness, but an ability to remember the child in us. And that's what will allow that child, that Kundalini, to rise, because the child isn't limited. It isn't told what it should and shouldn't do. And that's when the Kundalini starts to slumber, is when we live by other people's rules and not by our own.
It's one of the things that I love about you, Chris, your joy.
Well, I think we're fellow sisters in that, Carolyn.
Your joy and your love and desire to play. Something that you reminded me, you were talking about the tingle, the shivers. People report this or talk about this when they sense a truth.
Right.
And would you say that when you observe and feel a truth deeply, that perhaps this is part of the raising of Kundalini also?
I believe so. I feel that it's a reconnection. It's, as you say, it's when we have a truth, we are literally reconnecting to aha. It's the aha moment.
Mm-hmm.
And all the Kundalini is that marriage between our outer reality and the, sorry, all the tantric experiences are meeting of the outer reality to our inner one. So it's like hitting your blueprint. And what a perfect marriage. So that you're going along and going along, and all of a sudden you go, I get it. And that isn't something out there. It's as if something inside has now been reflected outside and vice versa. And that's intuition. And I've been taught a lot of intuition in my life in terms of helping people to recognize it. And one of the things I do is I say to people, look at what goes on when you have an aha. What are the signs or symptoms you get? Because that's a great way of knowing that it is your intuition.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll say, now remember the time when you wish you'd listened. What feelings did you have then? And everybody knows those ones.
Yep, true.
They go, oh, I felt awful. I felt drained. But if we, absolutely, we know when we're away from our center, when that union isn't happening, and we know when we're absolutely in tune with it. Of course, we don't always follow it, but we know.
Isn't that the truth? That's why they put erasers on pencils.
It's so true.
In that particular chapter, there was something interesting here that you drew, which I would call the infinity symbol.
Right.
And you give it the pole of existence.
Right.
And how that follows and meets in the middle.
Right.
Do you care to explain that to our audience? Because I found that fascinating.
Well, I would say it is the infinity sign. I was wanting to define that, and this is the little like a figure of eight on its side.
Yes.
And what I say is that we need to experience both sides, and so I call them poles of existence. And I usually use the example that if you're living just in one side, and perhaps you're a very responsible person, because I know this one well myself, what you will find very difficult is people who are irresponsible, because they're in the other pole. And because you need to know yourself in both sides, you will attract towards you people who are irresponsible. And inevitably, you will try and change them to be the miserable so-and-so that you are. Because how dare they be irresponsible? Well, in truth, what they're trying to help you to do is to know yourself in both poles. And so for me, the infinity, the ability to live in infinity is to be able to move between the two poles rather than just being in the center. Because it's the movement that brings the energy in. Does that make
sense?
Well,
as you're saying that, you know what that reminds me of truly is the admonition not to make judgment.
Oh, absolutely.
Because absolutely. That individual who is so different from you, if we judge them, we're losing the value of being able to learn a lesson from their experience. Is that an aha moment?
It's an aha moment, absolutely. And, of course, if we judge them, we commonly are judging that part within ourselves because anything we judge is usually inside us. And, of course, the more fervently we judge it, the more fearful we are of it.
You know, that's a fascinating concept. Do you care to repeat that? I think that's brilliant.
I'll say it again then. Yeah. Whatever we judge is usually what's within ourselves that we judge. And the more fervently we judge it, the more we are fearful of that part inside us.
Wow.
Because in a holographic universe, which is what I speak about, I'm going to say it, there is nobody outside us.
Yes.
It's just consciousness.
Yeah.
So the brilliant part is that we keep creating parts of us that we call reality so that we may know ourselves more fully.
This kind of connects to that, being aware, understanding ourselves more fully, and that gets into the next part of the chapter where you're talking about mirrors of awareness.
Right.
And I loved that.
Right.
Well, because I think this is something that we all need to do, is to be a little bit more aware as we move through life. And so perhaps you could discuss this little exercise that you give in here about walking down a road and writing down three things that catch your attention.
Oh, yes. I love that one.
Yes.
I'm going to keep repeating that if all we're here to do is to know ourselves, we will create in our environment, or we will only see in our environment, those things which reflect something inside us. So that it is all about our perception that will influence what we see. So what we know about ourselves or know about life is what we perceive. And we know this pretty well when it comes to witnesses at a scene of a crime, because they will only witness what they already know. That's why witnesses can be rather unhelpful in that situation. Well, what I get a group to do, or I get an individual, is to walk down the same road, and that 30 individuals will all see different things, and they will note them down. And what I'm fascinated is that they, even if it's the same sign, I mean, I remember one time it was outside the building where we were working, it said one way only. So everybody passed this same sign, but each of them interpreted that differently depending on their life. Somebody might say, well, there's only one way to go. That was a very easy answer. Mm-hmm. Another one said, I never go the way everybody else goes. I'm going to go another way. And it was just fascinating how everybody saw the sign differently. And then there would be people who never even saw the sign.
Yeah, I know some of those.
And I remember one person when we were doing this had gone into a ladies' bathroom, and she said, we'd all probably gone to the same bathroom at some point, but only she had seen a fortune cookie message lying on the floor that had given her an answer that she'd been waiting for some weeks.
Oh, that's incredible.
And none of us saw it. And so my question almost is, well, does that exist, or do we just see what we want to see? Does it matter? Because many a time it will show us what we want to hear, and that's very helpful for intuition. Because another thing I suggest is, if you want to have an answer, ask that you will see or hear or smell the answer within 20 minutes of asking the question.
Mm.
But once you get the answer, you're not then allowed to say, but give me another answer. And another one, I don't like that one.
You know, that gets into responsibility. I think sometimes people don't want to know the answer because instinctively they know that they're responsible now to carry out something.
Oh, absolutely. Isn't it better to say, oh, if only I had a better answer.
Or they say, well, I didn't see that sign.
I know. Well, I've been at the end of a consultation and someone's, after a lot of discussion, and someone said, so you can't help me then? You have no suggestions?
Oh, we're getting close to the time when we have to part, and, you know, this period went so fast. And I do want to cover one more thing, but I want to ask you if you would graciously come back another time and talk about your frontiers of health.
I would be delighted to, Karen. Thank you.
Yeah, that is so exciting. And I've got something else I wanted you to discuss, but before we get to that, I want you to mention your website again and places where people could go to purchase your books. Because first of all, I want to say to everybody out there who is hearing this, this is a book that you just want to put on your shelf and study and use and grow with it. There is real potential for growth in this if you just read it and look at some of the signs and absorb some of it.
Thank you so much. My website is christinepage.com. And all our books and tapes, I have CDs and tapes on there as well. Some of the books have been put into tape or CD for people who like to listen rather than read.
Mm-hmm.
Spiritual Alchemy hasn't actually put onto CD because I'm still trying to decide how to put the pictures in. That will have to be done in a different way, I think,
right,
because those pictures are so important. But yes, please, everything is there on my website, and also obviously looking at the courses I run or where they may want to come and hear me speak.
So even if you go to a place and look for a book like Amazon, it sounds to me like really the first place to go is to your website, because it has so much more other information in it besides just this particular book.
Absolutely. That would be a great place to start.
And so before we leave, perhaps there's one other topic, and you know, in a way, I think this is an excellent spot to stop, and that is on forgiveness.
I find that I've tried to redefine the forgiveness from the place of something that comes from the head, or it comes from a sense of pity, or it comes from a sense of I've forgiven them but I don't understand them. This is a very big statement. I'm going to say that it is not in condoning them for their actions, but at some level understanding where they are inside us. And that's a pretty tough call for some people, I understand. But forgiveness comes when we understand that aspect within ourselves, and we can accept it, and we literally integrate that part within us. Forgiveness comes from the heart, not from the head.
I would say
that forgiveness is a state that happens at the end of a process rather than at the beginning.
You know, in listening to what you are saying, it reminded me of the concept of this other person being a mirror to you.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, words like namaste and other words are really saying, I see you in me. I see another part of me in you. And it is by understanding that. It isn't by judging them nor judging us. It's just saying we all have aspects of each other in each other, and that is what makes us so unique and beautiful.
Oh, what a wonderful way to end this discussion with you, being unique and beautiful as you truly are. And I'm sure that our audience, in listening to your beautiful words and your enthusiasm, would agree with me that you truly are a lovely lady of the light.
Thank you.
Yes, and so we won't say goodbye. We'll just say to the next time.
Sure, and thank you for all the wonderful work you're doing, Carolyn, to bring all these thoughts together and to be the inspiration you are.
Oh, you're so sweet.
Thank you.
Thank you, dear. We'll be in touch.
Okay, take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Now, my dear listeners, I just wanted to bring up touch base with some current events, so to speak. I'm not sure if it was last week or the week before. I had given a...
Carolyn?
Yeah.
Hi. I was just wondering I need to bring you off the air for 2 minutes in order to get the next guest on.
Okay.
So do you want to take that now or finish up and then...
No, we'll take it now.
You got it. Well, to the wonderful audience, we'll be back in a few moments.
Good afternoon, friends. This is Carolyn Evers, and the second half of our show, I am so proud and delighted to bring forth a lovely lady. Golly, there's so much to say about her. I don't know where to start, except, first of all, that you might say she is a dedicated follower to Archangel Michael. Would that be fair to say, Mary?
Oh, yes, indeed it would. Carolyn, it's just so lovely to be with you.
Oh, I'm delighted to have you, Mary. Do me a favor and give me a correct pronunciation for your last name.
Yes, my name is Mary Majot. My father's family were French-Canadians.
I figured it was French, but I wasn't sure if that was a hard G or a soft G.
Yes. Yes, well, we've sort of used a patois and called it je. It's majeur.
Mary lives in Australia right now, and she's a spiritual teacher and author. And I was so fascinated when I listened to your meditation CD. We're going to get into that in a second, but I wanted you to talk a little bit about the Benedictine Priory of St. Scholastica in Duluth. Now, am I understanding this correctly, that you were there? Did you just study there, or were you a nun there?
Now, I did, yes, I began as a student.
Uh-huh.
It's a small liberal arts college located in Duluth, Minnesota, that's attached to the Benedictine Priory of St. Scholastica. And I was a music student in their program, and in about my third year of study, I felt very drawn, very attracted to the order itself. And I did enter the Benedictine order, and I stayed for a few years. But I did ultimately not continue on. I did leave after that.
The reason that I asked is when I played your tape, all I could see was this image of this religious. I felt like this wasn't the first time in your many lifetimes that you were part of a religious order. Did you have any insight into that? Is that following like a soul tradition?
Well, I had interesting kind of feelings of deja vu.
Yeah.
On a few occasions, but there was nothing as specific as I could just put my finger on. But there was always this underlying thing. You know, the Benedictines, I might just digress a little bit here. The Benedictines say the complete divine office. And that's a canonical prayer, the different hours of the day they gather and pray. And sometimes it's chanted. And they had a schola, too, that sang in Gregorian chant. And I used to, occasionally when I was singing in plain song, I would have these feelings of deja vu that, oh, you know, I've done this before somewhere, but I don't know where.
I could really see this and feel this and this great beauty from the past of spiritual achievement. And it really does come out for me in your voice and in your CD. And I think that is, it's first of all, what we're going to be talking about is this CD that you put out that is on meditation, your meditation CD. How did you come about to do this?
Now, I was very interested in sharing my meditation work. I had, of course, through the Benedictines, I had always practiced meditation. And St. Benedict has a very beautiful way of describing meditation. He calls it divine listening. And I always thought that was so simple, but so very profound and beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And when I began to teach meditation, I approached it from perhaps a slightly different angle. In the late 80s, I had a big sort of spiritual wake-up, and I started to investigate meditation as it was taught by the Buddhists and in some of the classical Indian schools. And what I wanted to do was to integrate those two wonderful traditions, the Christian meditation tradition with the more classical practices from the East. And I began to teach meditation at the University of the Third Age here where I live. This was in about the year 2000. And students said, oh, wouldn't it be nice if we could have some sort of a home study guide that we could work with when we're away from the classes? And that's what motivated me to write and then record and produce my my CD.
I think the music that you put on the CD is especially good. I really like that. I thought it was very relaxing and helped get you into the state that you were looking for.
Good, yes. I used, interestingly enough, I used an Indian raga. Because the music is it's simple and repetitive, but somehow I think it does lead us, it's quite surreptitious there in the background, but it provides a platform that I hope, you know, helps people to relax and to free up their mind.
the word meditation is one of those words that everybody uses, and perhaps we say we do it. And I'm not sure if we really do it or if this is a goal that we have. And for some people, I would say it's very difficult to understand what it is and to get there.
Yes, I have to agree totally with you, Carolyn. It's an ideal that we can aspire to, or I like to describe it as it's a journey, it's a process. You never, in a sense, really arrive at it because it's always a becoming thing. And I think it's just something that we do if we're motivated to do so, to really help us to relax and to keep our ego mind under control, to clear the mind and to perhaps give us techniques to be more in command of what we are thinking about and how we're thinking. But it goes on and on. I think, you know, it's just something that you do without perhaps ever really actually arriving at it. Yes, go ahead.
Perhaps that's true. Maybe we never do really get there totally. Maybe it's something that we're continuously growing. But I was intrigued with a couple things on your CD. First of all, the fact that you have done this, I think it's a marvelous aid, and everybody should have it in their library. But you talked about a sacred space between the intake and the in-breath and the out-breath. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yes. It's something that has to be felt by an individual, and they may not feel it until perhaps they're absolutely ready to. I know it's very personal, and one can't say that this should be something that everybody should try to achieve, because it's possible that it may not be right for certain people. But I use a lot of breath techniques when I teach meditation. And when we draw in a breath very slowly and hold it within ourselves, we focus not externally in any way, but we're always working from the inside out. And there is this little space between an in-breath and an out-breath that you can feel your way into it. And that when you can reach it, and you don't have to stay there very long, because, of course, the lungs say, all right, now I've got to expel this breath so I can take in another one. So it's very touchy-feely. But you get there, and if you can just stay in that little place for perhaps a brief time, and maybe each breath you can extend that, you get into a space. I called it the sacred space, but you can almost sense a presence behind the breath there, or you can feel a place where you don't seem to be in linear time. It's very strange. It's hard to express it in words.
Oh, you're doing quite well.
It's hard to talk about these things because they're very personal, and they're very transient. And our vocabulary, you know, you struggle all the time to get the words to say what you're feeling and thinking about.
But, you know, I think this is very important to discuss, because most people really don't have a teacher for these sorts of things.
Yeah.
And they're kind of moving around this in the dark, and they're trying to learn. And what I feel like your CD does is it's sort of like a shortcut to help people focus and get to a point where they really want to go.
Well, yes, this is what I was hoping it would achieve. And often, too, you know, if a person is wanting to make a meditation and they have everything right, you know, that they have the time and they have the inclination, and they can get there and they can perhaps be tired, or they can have a little headache, or the energy levels are low. And I always say you might need a crutch for this particular time. So put on the CD and work through the guided meditation that I have, and use that as a platform,
mm-hmm.
and possibly it can just kickstart you more effectively into the meditation itself.
Well, in addition to that, I think the CD is very good to put on, to listen, to work with, to form a habit. You know,
yes.
We have a tendency, I think meditation should really be something that is done every day, and sometimes it's really hard to commit that time. And so putting the CD in your player and working with it is a marvelous way to get into the habit of doing this every day.
Yes, I would hope it could be a real aid to people,
mm-hmm.
because it takes an enormous amount of self-discipline to just sit down on your own and continue this practice. And of course there's the added advantage too, that there is a form of meditation, and this has come from the Buddhists, where you can meditate in the midst of your daily activities.
That was another question I was going to get to.
Maybe I'm jumping ahead here.
This is really important. I want you to elaborate on that.
All right. Now, we live these very busy lives, of course. We have a lot of demands on our time. And, excuse me, I'm just going to clear my throat. Yeah, pardon me. sometimes we can't commit, you know, a few minutes to what I call sitting meditation. But we can meditate when we're doing quiet activities on our own. And I always like to use the analogy of preparing meals, because we women, we never retire, you know. We just keep on cooking. We have to do so much of that. And I always say, if you have to prepare a meal, why not make your meal preparation a meditation? You know, take your food. I mean, here in Australia, on the East Coast where I live, we have the most beautiful tropical fruits in the summer, and we always have fresh fruit for breakfast, and the fruits have such gorgeous colors. And I always say to the people, look, take your piece of fruit, and when you wash it, just feel its texture, and when you peel it, you know, enjoy the colors, and you'll start making a connection with the earth, with, you know, you're working actually with earth energies when you approach it this way, and enjoy the whole experience of just preparing a bowl of cut fruit for the family. You know, cook with love. And that is a meditation, because you're focused, your awareness is focused on what you're doing in the present moment, and you're probably relaxed and feeling a sense of joy when you do this. And so this active meditation, this can bring your whole life into your meditation period in an active way, and it's quite enriching, I think, personally.
What we're really talking about here, I think, is being aware and in the moment every second that you can.
Yes, it's that sort of living in the now,
mm-hmm.
the now moment.
Mm-hmm.
And doing simple things, but if they're done with focus and awareness, that actually in a relaxed state, that becomes a meditation. I've done a lot of work with seniors, and I always tell them, you know, take the quiet moments of the day and enjoy those, but you have to also accept everything in your life. So if you're having a bad arthritic day, and I have them, feel your aches and your pains. Just participate in them, but don't judge them. They may not be pleasant, but yet you're acknowledging them, and it's part of your life. Therefore, you're actually making that into a meditation. So all of these little things, they make us aware of our daily lives, and I think they're enriching.
Indeed. And I think in our busy world, where it seems that the world is getting busier and busier, if
yes.
you follow that path, you really lose awareness as you walk through life.
Yes, you do.
So
you do. Yeah,
I think
we have all these awful demands made on us. I mean, with now, you know, with, I mean, telephones are wonderful. Here you and I are chatting away, and we're 10,000 miles apart on two sides of the world.
Isn't it amazing?
It is wonderful. It's just marvelous. I've always said that this is a precursor to full consciousness.
I think you're right.
Yeah, we've got the internet, and we've got television, and yet we have to use these things in a mindful way. We can't allow them to just take us over, or we will lose our focus.
You know, it's interesting, as you were talking about that, the internet and telephones and so forth, I'm sitting here at my desk, and I'm looking out this window on a green lawn with trees, and I saw this little butterfly. I go both ways. Pass me one way, turn around, and go the other. It was like, you know, you're aware of me. I had this sense that, yeah, we've got all this technology, but we need to be aware of the butterfly, of the growing tree, of the grass that's green.
Yes.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. I had a question when you were talking about this sacred space between the in-breath and the out-breath. I've heard in some disciplines where they talk about placing the tongue on the roof of the mouth, and I noticed that this was not mentioned on the CD. Was there any reason that it wasn't, or do you perhaps feel that this was an interference with the sacred space?
Well, I just see it, what I believe it does is that it closes the energy system within the body when you do that. It's part of the tantric tradition too, which is kind of an interesting thought. But I wanted to keep the, because this is beginning people. I try to work with members of the general public, and this also comes from the Eastern tradition. You know, when we meditate, sometimes you see people sitting with their hands on their thighs, and they've made a circle between their thumb and their index finger. They have that little circle there, and it's the same kind of a thing. It's closing this energy field within the body. But I would get specific like that if I were going to perhaps teach an ongoing type of meditation class.
Oh, we need an ongoing meditation class, don't we?
Yeah, we do. And I'm starting to do one, interestingly enough. I've been teaching now for about, since working with meditation groups since the mid-1990s. And, you know, the classes come up, and there are people that book them out, and then there's another group that wants to start. And I've been having this intake of new people constantly over these years. And yet I've thought to myself, wouldn't it be nice if there was some opportunity for them to maybe go a little bit deeper and go on. And I'm going to try to do that in our fourth term this year, which is, this is the term, you know, here in Australia. I might mention we start the academic year in January. It's a calendar year. It stops in December. So I'm thinking in October, perhaps, in part of November, to try to do this.
Yes, I think that people who pick up on this one would certainly perhaps want to go to the next one. Perhaps you could give us some insight as to what happens when you close the energy loop. In other words, whether it's putting the tongue on the roof of your mouth or you know, making, what happens when you close that energy loop?
All right. I was interested in the Eastern traditions because they understand energy, just the universal life force, the prana, or the chi, if you want to call it that, or the ki, if you're in Japan. They understand this life force better, really, than the Christian tradition does. And I wanted to study that and learn something about it. And when we meditate, there's a lot going on up in the two hemispheres of the brain. And I'd like to, if we don't do that this morning, we might be able to talk about that another time. Because I think it's very interesting. Do we have time today?
Oh, yeah, we've got time, Mary, if you want to cover that, because
You wouldn't mind if I'd elaborate on that a little bit?
No, I think this is a good time to do that.
Oh, all right. It really, once a person is deeply relaxed, that's the first part of meditation. I call that the meditation tightrope. You've got to put one foot in front of the other, and the first foot that goes on the tightrope is the ability to relax deeply. And I take people through exercises that get them into that stage. Then the next step is to be able to put the second foot on the tightrope, which is to clear the mind of difficult little, you know, interruptive thoughts, and put oneself into a focused awareness in the present. When they can achieve those two things simultaneously, there is a marvelous change that goes on in the brain. I had a workshop with an Indian doctor. He's in the at the head of the Department of Nuclear Medicine at the Sydney Royal Women's Hospital. And he does a lot of work with CAT scans and MRIs, and did this with people in meditative states so that he could actually get a picture of the electric firing that was going on between the two brain hemispheres. And that was the basis of his workshop, and it was so enlightening and so interesting. When we are in our busy, active, everyday life, focused outside there in the third dimension, we are in the left brain, or the beta part, the masculine part of our brain, because we've got two hemispheres, of course. The left hemisphere is this beta, and the brain firing is very quick, 14 to about 33 cycles per second. So it's extremely active. We're organizing, we're thinking, we're making lists, we're doing all that kind of thing. If we get over into the right side of the brain, which we do in meditation, that is the feminine, or the alpha side. And the brain waves are much slower. They're moving from only 7 to 14 cycles per second. This side is more about being. It's more creative. It tends to have more of a sense of awareness rather than the busy doing side of the other hemisphere. Now, when you get into alpha, what happens to the brain, to the left brain, is that it drops its function, and it takes up the same electric firing pattern as the alpha side does, and you suddenly move into this whole brain firing awareness thing. And when you do that, some marvelous things happen in the body. You begin to produce endorphins, which are neurochemicals. The body produces them, and they have a very benign effect. They actually move through the body, and they seek out and destroy free radical cells that, of course, are the ones that are cancer-producing. They get the whole body into a very deeply relaxed and healthy state, and they even claim to be anti-aging. As I tell the women, it's cheaper than Botox if you can meditate. You can keep your yourself looking much younger and fresher. But once you kick into that alpha brain firing state, this is what happens. And then, of course, you can maintain that by closing that energy that's surging through the body, creating all this wonderful chemical stuff. You can do that through these techniques of, you know, the tongue on the roof of the mouth.
Right.
Yes. Are you there, dear?
I'm there. No,
oh, good. We're not running out of time.
No. We have.
Oh, I don't want to talk too much.
No.
You have to interrupt me.
I want to hear what you have to say, because I think you're bringing concepts to our audience that they want to hear.
Oh, well, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you might have another question or another avenue to follow. I'm just having a little drink of water here.
See, I forgot my water. I don't know if you can answer this. We're talking about... about when you get to the point where both sides of the brain are in the alpha state.
Yes.
And that sounds to me like perhaps this is the ultimate goal in, well, not the ultimate goal, but one of the big doorways that we need to go through when we're meditating. Would you maybe, you know, there's several goals, and maybe that's the first goal. Would you agree with that?
Yes, yes, I would. I would. Because, you know, it's an antidote to this 20th century life that we're living.
Mm-hmm.
It to the excesses of it and the demands on our nervous system. We've all got overworked nervous systems, those of us in the West. The people in the East don't, because they have a totally different approach, you know, to life than
mm-hmm.
we have. I think they're more content with being rather than doing, which we are a very much a doing Western culture, I think. And yes, if we can even just give ourselves 10 minutes a day to take time out to get into this alpha state and stay there, you know, put the engine on idle, so to speak, and it would be so, so renewing, even just to the physical body. And then, of course, it's providing this doorway that does lead one into, I think, a deeper sense of spirituality as well.
Now, that's the next step I wanted to go to. First of all, I see that as the first doorway that we are moving through, getting both sides of the brain to be in alpha. And you gave us a little insight as to what that will do to the physical.
Yes.
Now, if we get through that doorway, let's look at the spiritual aspect. Do you have an opinion as to, as you go through that doorway, what the next step would be towards the spiritual?
Yes. Now, this would be, of course, a personal thing.
Yes.
Because everybody, you know, will have, they'll have a different way of arriving at this, and they'll have a different experience of it, too. But if one can, all right, pass through the doorway, you will find yourself moving into a deeper state of consciousness. It's though you're sort of falling down into a very peaceful, gentle, quiet place within yourself. And you can rest there. It's a sense of really deep bliss when you can reach that. And you can linger there. And as you do, I think you become aware of that connection between your physical, this is a strange thing to say, and I'm trying to find the words. You get a connection that's more direct between your physical body and your soul. I think you begin to see, you begin to sort of sense the spiritual part of yourself. And that can open up into, you know, a whole array of inner exploration. It can probably ultimately lead to this sense of connection to your higher self, and then ultimately to your you know, the I am presence, the monad, and so on. And it can go where perhaps, you know, you're supposed to be taken. But I think that for most of us, just to get through that first doorway and to find ourselves moving into that peaceful stillness within and resting there, and then here's where St. Benedict kicks in, divine listening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're just being there. We're just not thinking, trying to think of anything. We're just resting and being and enjoying that beautiful sensation of the present moment.
Now, I realize, Mary, that this is going to take a period of development to get there. This is going to be a gradual journey.
Absolutely. It's a lifetime journey.
Yes.
Mm.
However, there's another doorway past there. And I'm wondering if you're prepared to discuss that. And what I had in mind was that point where one links to their I am presence.
Yes. Yes.
How would you describe that?
All right. I think that we're all electromagnetic energy in a biological body. I always call this body our overcoat, in a sense. And we're much more complex than just this physical body. Although this is the one that we've focused on so exclusively for so long, because that's the only one that we really can perceive with our five senses, with any great immediacy. There are three other bodies, too. They're energetic bodies. They're a spiritual body, a mental body, and an emotional body. And then there's the physical. There are these four, and they're all interwoven together in ourselves. And in this electromagnetic, these other three bodies, circle around us, and they make up our aura. Now, before we can get to the I am presence, I think we have to go through our higher self. And I'm tiptoeing around here a bit. I think once, we become aware of these other bodies and they become balanced within our personality, we have to have a balanced physical body, one that, we have no substance abuse, we eat sensibly, we get rest, we take care of our bodies, we don't abuse them in any way or overstretch them. Then we can move on, perhaps, into the emotional body, and we have to live through, these relationships that we have. Some of them are difficult, traumatic. We might have all kinds of stuff from the past that we're carrying along with us, painful memories. Those have to be brought up and cleansed and cleared, and then we'll have a balanced emotional body. The spiritual body, has to be brought into balance. We have to become aware of it. We have to know that we are spirit in matter. We're just really a spiritual being having a physical experience. We have to be on a path now where we're wanting to grow spiritually, beginning to read spiritual material, perhaps praying more often, perhaps joining a meditation group or taking a class. So we have this, now we're connecting all those bodies in a very positive way. And when that happens, when we get the mental, the physical, the spiritual, the emotional body all together, I think we become then our higher self. And when that happens, when we're working with integrity and awareness, from that point, then I think the doorway to the I am presence opens up. Now, that's personal. You might have people that come forth and ring you up after and they say, she's way off the beam. And that's fine.
I think people realize.
I can only speak for my own self here.
Now, do you have an opinion on this, that when you open that doorway to the I am presence, is that something that one lives with continuously, or would you say this is like brief flashes of inspiration?
Yes. I think it's probably, for me at this stage, it's the latter. It's interesting. I think you have to search for the higher self. You have to acknowledge the fact that you are wanting to develop a relationship with your oversoul, with your I am presence. And one of my friends, he's a very fine channel who lives in Sydney, and he's done some marvelous work here in Australia in the very early days, in the 70s and 80s. His name is Soltec. And he's done a great deal of writing. He's a wonderful spiritual writer. He gave me an exercise or an affirmation that I used to use. I am that I am. I'm calling upon my I am presence to acknowledge me, because I wish to open myself to you, to your wonderful benefits. I want to, you know, draw myself into a relationship with you. And I think you have to start to actually cultivate that relationship through prayer, perhaps, or affirmations made in meditation. And slowly, and it takes a long time, the higher self, you know, seems to be very hidden from us. There will be moments where you will sense what that presence is. And you will begin to get, like you said, flashes of intuition. I know I had one this morning. Right now, it's between 7 and 8 a.m. for me on Sunday morning, the 11th of June, here in Australia. And I set my clock for 6 this morning because I had a feeling that I should get up early and get myself dressed and sort of set things up because you were going to start to interview me at 7. Something said, get yourself prepared in so that you can get to the phone. And it was about 10 to 6 when my clock
ran. Right. Oh, I'm so sorry about that.
No, it was good because it was my higher self.
No,
you know, it was wonderful because it gave me an opportunity to listen to it and to follow through. And I did that. And the fellow rang me at 6 and said, you know, from the United States. And I said, oh, I'm so pleased you've called me because I know that the phone numbers are accurate. And we've got a good satellite connection here to do this talk. And I said, you've also helped me in another way, too. And I didn't tell him what it was. But I thought, oh, this is good. So I was able to have a cup of coffee and get myself all set and get my husband up. And then I was ready at 7. So there you go. But it works like that. It's little flashes. Get up, Mary. Get up earlier than usual and sort of be prepared. And you have to follow those. At first you feel, gee, you know, is this just something I'm imagining or should I just ignore this? And then after a while you get to feel, you know, when you should really listen.
You know, that is an interesting point. I think a lot of us are touched with flashes and think that it's not real and ignore them.
Yes, yeah, we all do it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we have to start now to consciously see if we're mentally focused and not distracted as much. If the mind, because the mind does learn to be disciplined if you practice meditation, I think you become more sensitive to these little things. Excuse me, and to after a while you begin to think, wait a minute, I'm not going to push this aside. I'm going to follow it.
Mm-hmm.
It's an intuition. It's probably something genuine here, meant for me for a reason.
And so you feel that the more you meditate, the more you're apt to hear this and follow these spiritual promptings.
Oh, indeed. Indeed you are, yes. It's a process. You know, the whole thing is an inner sensitizing process. It connects you to, you know, to all these spiritual things, and it comes from within ourselves. I mean, Jesus Christ said, the kingdom of God is within you. And we've been looking outside. The churches have put us outside all the time, looking out, you know, outward for God. But no, it we go within.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You're so right about that. It's very important for us to go within and find what is the truth for us and how we are to be led.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have an opinion about this, Mary, because we're talking about a subject that kind of leads into this.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that we have a contract that, you know, with spirit that we can either follow or not follow or change?
Yes, very much so. I think we come in with a spiritual contract. I mean, there are certain lessons that have to be learned or cleared, maybe re-experienced, so that they can be cleared, and that will open us to further growth. But I think it's of a very, I don't think it's terribly specific. I think it's a general sort of thing, and situations in the life may come up where perhaps a person decides that they would like to change tack and do something, within their contract, but maybe they move through it quicker and they want to go on to something different and new that could be more beneficial to them. So, I do think that there's a certain something or other that is going to be achieved in this particular lifetime that one finds themselves in.
Well, that's what I was really getting at, because what is explained to me many times is that we know that there's a high road, a middle road, and a low road, and that basically we come in on a contract that is on the middle road.
Yes.
And if we work our way through this and have a desire that we could actually move up to the higher road and advance much further.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's all determined by our intention and our heart, the kind of love, you know, you have to want to pursue this path. Absolutely. And we might even climb up to the higher road. Who knows?
I know that path gets pretty steep and slippery.
Yeah, I think probably I'd be content if I could just get the higher road.
You told me earlier, before we really started to discuss about getting together and talking about your work, that you were, a close admirer to Archangel Michael.
Yes, I love Archangel Michael dearly.
I know.
Yes,
when
he's my...
I can't hear you.
Yes. Okay. We're right now. I think we had a bubble in the transmission. Yes.
Yes.
Go ahead, Carolyn.
No, I was asking you about, like, I knew that you had this connection with Archangel Michael, and I was going to explore that a little, like, when you first were aware of him. Was this, like, through a meditative state, like when you were working with your meditation?
Not so much that as through some of the reading that I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, I've lately been very drawn, well, to your site. I was just led to it. This is where I must go. And also the Circle of Light, Izin.
Yes.
I'm very fond of Lady Isis, and she has even published some of my writings on her Izin. I was very happy about that.
Of course.
And it seemed all of a sudden that everything... In my life, I had had a different focus before this, a spiritual focus. I was doing a lot of work with Janice O'Rose, who is in Sedona. And, we were working with the Ashtar Command very, very intimately and with, you know, Tuella and her books and that sort of thing. But then all of a sudden, I had this feeling that I should be moving in another direction, and it was toward Archangel Michael. He was very strong.
Mm-hmm. He was gathering you in, huh?
Yes, exactly. And then he gave me a push.
Matthias talks about a kick.
Yes, that would be good. That's a better way to...
He gives you that little kick up.
It's a good description. I'm just glad I didn't land on my chin.
No, he makes sure you don't land on your chin. I wanted to mention that because I want our audience to know that we're going to be having a round table with members from Archangel Michael's membership, the round table, and you're going to be one who's going to come on board for that little chat.
Oh, I'd love that.
I know. It's going to be so marvelous because these are all great lovers of Archangel Michael, and we're going to be talking about the lessons what life with the great Archangel means to us individually. That's going to be fun.
Oh, wonderful. Look, I'd love to be a part of that, Carolyn. You've got to just keep me informed as to when and where.
And... We will, yeah. We've got this set up. We're going to have a little group. We're going to have a round table. And I want the audience to know that that's coming up in a few weeks.
Oh, excellent. Like a little conference call to air.
Yes, yes.
Wonderful. Yeah, wonderful. Well, I'll be part of that.
Yeah, and we'll be able to share ideas.
Yes.
Before we go, Mary, what I would like for you to do is to tell us again your website and give us a little rundown on your work. In other words, I know that there's other things that you have besides this CD, but I just thought it was so important. I wanted to focus most of our discussion on that, and because I felt like you had so much to offer us by way of informational meditation.
Yes, yes. Now, all right, I do teach classes. I have a 10-week class that I'm presently teaching, and what I do is that I take the first 6-week sessions, and I use that as my introduction to meditation and spiritual awakening. And you know, people take this, and that's the one that's being filled up all the time. I do one each term. I'm starting an ongoing meditation for 4 weeks in the fourth term, and I'm going to see if I can pick up a few extra people who have expressed this desire to go on. So there's the teaching aspect. I do a lot of writing. I contribute articles regularly to Insight magazine, which is probably Australia's leading New Age magazine. And I write for Rainbow News, which is published in New Zealand. It's a lovely, lovely little magazine that comes out of the country there. And I send writings to websites and to other publications, too. Now, I had a big internet website. I have had to take it offline. But what I do is I have an email newsletter that I send out to a community. It's free. It goes out about every 6 weeks to an online community of people who just indicate their interest by giving me their email. And I put them into the community and send these out. It's called Insights, Spiritual News and Views. And what you would do is you'd have to contact me through email. And so I'll give my email address now.
I wish you would.
Yes. Now, it's K for Ken, it's my husband, M for Mary, 3, the number 3, high note, HIGHNOTE. Now, that's all one word lowercase, KM3, high note, at BigPond, one word, .com. So just once more,
yes.
KM3, high note, it's BigPond.com.
And so if somebody emailed you and wanted to receive your newsletter, they just ask for the newsletter?
That's right. And what I do, I have a sample edition. I send that, and then if they're interested and want to go further, they can just send me a reply email, and I'll put them into the list.
Mm-hmm.
And then if anybody wants to unsubscribe, all they have to do is send me a blank email and put unsubscribe in the subject line.
Have you ever considered of putting your classes on tapes and make them available to people outside of Australia?
Well, you know, I've thought about it. It would be a big job.
Is it?
Yes. Yes, I think I'd rather, each one of the newsletters that I give has a little section called Meditation Tips.
Oh, great.
And, yeah, I try to, bring new things in to keep people moving along with it, even though they're not in a class.
Mm-hmm.
But that stretches me about what I can cope with at the moment.
Well,
I'm in my mid-70s.
There's so many hours in the day.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
Well, Mary, we have enjoyed your company so much.
Oh, yes. I've loved meeting you, Carolyn.
And I love meeting you, too.
Yes, and, I thank you personally for setting up the Conclave website, because it is wonderful, and it's going to become an absolute magnet. I've tried to let people know about it. I've sent emails to about 40 different light workers and told them to drop in and have a look. So, we may be able to get some more Conclave members coming aboard, but it's a wonderful service you're offering.
That's so kind of you to say that. I really appreciate you saying that. We work hard at it. We try to serve. And, you know, it was Archangel ordered it. What can I say?
Yes, yes. He does. And he's very specific, and he won't give up.
You know, you're talking about being specific. Mary, he literally designed that cover. That cover that's on that book, Earth History?
Yes.
That wasn't something that Mattia and I designed. He designed it.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Yes,
beautiful.
He designed it. And there's a picture of the planet Earth, as you're well aware. And there are crystals in that. When people come to the website at ArchangelMichaelsConclave.com, they see the cover of the book, and there are crystals on the outside of the Earth. Well, he designed that. He said that is the way the Earth was before the fall at Atlantis.
Oh, isn't that beautiful?
Yes.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah. And he is so specific about he really knows exactly what he wants.
Oh, he does. He does.
He's very precise. And I said to him, I didn't know archangels were so precise. And he said, we've got to take care of all these energies here on Earth. We have to be precise. We've got to know exactly what we want to do.
Oh, it's wonderful, isn't it?
Oh, I tell you, working with him and getting to know him has really been a blessing.
Oh, what a wonderful experience, Carolyn, you've had.
Yes, wonderful. I really have.
Yes.
He wants a relationship close to people. You know, for so long we've had him on a pedestal, and he
exactly. In fact, I was always a little bit afraid of him. I was in an aura, you know.
I felt that way too.
Yes, and he seemed to be a very stern sort of archangel, but he's not. He's not. He's very loving.
He is extremely loving. There's a story on the website at BBS Radio where I describe my first experience with him. And when you read those words, if you haven't read that, Mary, you ought to really go and read it, because I was at Mount St. Michael in France when I had that experience, and I had a tape recorder with me. And that's why I spoke right into the tape recorder and repeated everything that he said and described the circumstances.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so detailed.
Oh, isn't that wonderful? See, there was your higher self that somehow inspired you, your I Am presence, to have that tape recorder with you.
That
was planned.
Thank you for saying that, Mary. But what I think it was is I'm one of these people who try to fill up a suitcase.
Lovely.
I had to put a couple more things in it.
Fill up that little corner over there.
That's right. I had a little corner. And so when you read his words about how he feels towards humanity.
Oh, beautiful. Beautiful.
Yes. If you haven't read it, do read it, because my point of view, it really gives you the feeling of just who and what he is.
Yes, I shall do.
But I have to say, he is a taskmaster.
Oh, that's good. We need him. We need him to crack his little energetic whip.
He does have one.
Yes.
Oh, Mary, it's been a delight, and we can't wait to have you back when the conclave gathers.
Oh, lovely. Well, keep me in touch, Claire, and I'd love meeting you, and we will work together again.
Of course we will.
Yes.
I love you, dear heart.
Yeah, love you, too. God bless. And to all your audience, too, blessings and light and love.
Thank you.
Yes. Goodbye,
Bye.
Carolyn. Goodbye, dear.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And so, dear friends, there's not quite enough time to get into this information with Mother Mary, but we'll touch base again with this Sunday when we meet once more. And to all of you, I have a very special place in my heart for each and every one of you, full of love, and may we touch again soon. Goodbye.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a Service to Others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.